We'll move to the next case of the morning, which is United States versus Hendrick. Wait till everybody gets settled down. Okay, Mr. Kelly.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Chris Kelly, and I represent Larry Hendricks in this appeal from a judgment of conviction. The first issue that I want to address this morning is whether the government violated Mr. Hendricks' right to equal protection by striking from the jury panel all of the African Americans. The district court recognized that the government's exercise of those strikes was prima facie evidence of an intent to discriminate. The district court failed to recognize, however, that the government's explanation of its exercise of those strikes was pretextual. The government offered...
Isn't that a finding of fact?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that a finding of fact?
It is a finding of fact,
it's but... Less than a challenge for cause, a finding for fact that the statement was not pretextual.
Yes, it certainly...
As a general thing, prosecutors do not like people on jury who have relatives in the penitentiary serving terms, or have had relatives in the penitentiary serving terms. If I recall, a white juror was discharged for precisely that reason.
One of two white jurors who had relatives who had served some prison time or jail time was struck.
Right.
Both black jurors were struck.
Those are the only two black jurors on the panel, if I recall correctly.
That's correct, Your Honor. So the government exercised its strikes against all of the black jurors, but only half of the white jurors.
Well, that's an interesting way of looking at it.
And I think one issue here is if the government had struck only the two black jurors who had relatives in prison and none of the white jurors, you might say, well, there's really a lack of any other explanation because people were sitting on the jury with exactly the same characteristic as the people who were struck, and there's something that's very troubling about that fact. But as soon as you have the government striking one white juror who also has that characteristic, you dilute the force of that assumption. Maybe the prosecutor just wasn't aware of that other white juror's relative, or thought that there are different levels of culpability, or, I mean, there are many other things. Here we, and I guess what I'm getting to is not only are there, is the inference weaker when you have one white juror struck, but also the way this was handled, where the district court looks into it, you know, flags the issues, but then everybody sort of seems to drop it, means that the rest of these facts are not investigated. Maybe the prosecutor would have had more to say, maybe the defendant would have had more to say, but there's very little follow-up at the trial to really flesh out the rest of the thinking, and surely that at this point is the defendant's problem. I mean, somebody should have spoke up and said, we need more facts, don't we?
Well, I think the facts were there. I think the defense counsel at trial could have made a better argument from those facts.
So we got a daily transcript, looked at it for 6 days. I'm not saying you, whoever it was. And then just said, Judge, remember, we got a Batson challenge here or something like that. Instead of saying, hey, Judge, there's another one on here. Before we get this trial going, there's another person that they didn't throw out, and we've got a problem. And then perhaps the judge could have addressed it, and maybe the prosecution said, throw her out too, we'll get another one in here, or something. But that was never done. And it's almost like putting this, quote, error in the pocket and see what the verdict is and then bringing it up. And that looks like what happened.
Well, I don't know that I agree with that, Your Honor. I do agree that defense counsel...
You got daily copy. They did that for some reason.
I don't know if they... I don't know what defense counsel's motivation was. What I can say is that the facts were in front of the judge. The judge presided over the voir dire. The judge heard the... actually asked the voir dire questions and heard the answers
The final thing is to decide whether the judge decides that what the prosecutor said makes sense sufficient so that she thinks it's a perfectly legitimate reason for dropping him without getting involved with the racial thing.
And that,
there's nothing unusual about that either.
Well, there's nothing unusual about the judge performing that role, but I think what the judge missed here is the evidence of pretext. And what the Supreme Court told us in the the latest Miller L. decision, is that when a prosecutor strikes black panelists for reasons that apply equally to white panelists, that's strong evidence of pretext.
But they did drop a white panelist. We just got to
one.
Did drop
one.
Well,
one of the two. And the
I have
statement
to go back and relive it, but I'm saying at the time, in the context of this, the judge knew all of the things you're talking about and concluded
yes.
that the prosecutors were giving a legitimate reason for dropping that was not race-related. And that seems to me to be the end of the story as far as a factual finding by the judge. You know, you don't think the judge herself was corrupt or...
No, of course not, Your Honor, but I don't know that the judge...
You
considered as carefully as she
should have. Well,
the fact that, for instance, Pat Martin or Mr. Martin's brother had served time for armed robbery, just as Juror Woodland's stepson had served time for armed robbery, and yet Martin stays on and Woodland doesn't. There's no logical explanation for that, given the prosecutor's statement that he struck everyone he could who had relatives in prison. Well, that's not true, because he could have struck Martin and he didn't.
At what time does that fact come out, though, about the brother of Mr. Martin having served for that precise crime?
It came out during the voir dire.
So
it was certainly known to the judge when the judge listened to the prosecutor's explanation.
Well, the prosecutor's explanation, as Judge Bauer says, the judge figures that once the prosecutor's given this explanation and has actually struck a white juror also, she's convinced that the prosecutor essentially is telling the truth. In part, it's a credibility determination, which is why I think we're having trouble understanding how we get behind that without a fuller set of objections from defense counsel saying, no, judge, you know, there's still a juror sitting who has this problem. You know, there's some question about what's the relevant comparison. Is the comparison one between the two white jurors, between the white juror who is struck and the two African-American jurors, or is the right comparison between the white juror who continues to sit and the African-American jurors?
Well, I think we had kind of similar issues in Miller L., and certainly the standard of review is the same in Miller L., but the Supreme Court...
But in Miller L., the Supreme Court wasn't looking at a package of African-American jurors plus a few white jurors who are exactly the same. The facts are just a little different in Miller L.
Well, don't I recall that the issue was raised sui sponte by the court?
Initially, it was raised sui sponte by the court.
Well,
that's right.
Initially is it, was how it's raised.
Correct.
Yes. This initial and raised it is the same thing. Okay. So that the defense attorney was apparently not particularly concerned with the issue until court raised it herself.
I don't know that that's the case. I think it may have been the case that the judge simply raised it before the defense counsel had a chance to. I think defense counsel probably would have raised it if the court hadn't kind of beaten
but
him to the
that
punch.
But that isn't what happened. But I'm saying that one of the things is that it didn't look like it got anybody upset any place along the line. Nor was there a scream of wounded pain when she said she accepted it.
I didn't attend the trial, so I can't tell from the transcript whether anybody was
you're
screaming.
You're doing the same thing we're doing. You're reading a cold record.
Yes.
And this is one of the reasons why you don't upset factual findings, is because reading the cold record is a little different than being there in the atmosphere when you know what's going on.
Well, the Supreme Court read a cold record in Miller L., and despite a deferential standard
of
review.
You can work on it. But there are a number of cases in the Supreme Court that take the same position Judge Crabb took, that you know, the explanation is perfectly appropriate, and that's the end of that. Goes on.
And
but I don't think you ought to waste all the rest of your time, because
okay,
at least you got your problem down cold.
I just wanted to say that there's one more issue, and that's the prosecutor's reference to taking juror or potential juror Woodland off because he was a CSI guy, but leaving on, again, two white jurors who were also CSI fans. So there's more to it than just whether somebody had a relative in prison here. None of it really adds up very well, and that's why I think that the judge didn't do a sufficiently careful job of taking a look at the issue. The next issue that I want to address deals with the government's violation of the motion in limine. Before the trial started, the defense had moved the court for an order precluding the prosecution from mentioning the fact that a search warrant had been approved by a judge. And
the fact that there was a warrant certainly was going to go in, wasn't it?
Yes, and the judge ruled that.
Can you tell me in the abstract what was wrong with the jury knowing that a judge issued a search warrant?
Because
apart from the fact that you just told them not to do it,
this court's decision in Cunningham teaches us that the procedures that are used to gather the evidence just aren't relevant in a criminal trial.
Absolutely,
it's the evidence that's relevant.
Right.
And the difficulty with the jurors knowing that a judge approved the search warrant, particularly in this case where they also.
But once you get the fact of a search of a warrant in there, what is the idea that the jurors are not supposed to know what a warrant is or how it works or what?
Well, it's not relevant to anything. Certainly, that's what the court held.
Well, I want to know, however, whether you think it's error to tell the jurors that, you know, the cops went in there with a warrant. They were coming in legitimately, and that if somebody wants to know what a warrant is something that's issued by a judge, whether he's right or wrong.
I think in the context of this case, the error is that the jury heard evidence about a confidential informant who provided information to the police. The police took that information to the judge.
But that issue is attacking the validity or the right of the court to issue the warrant in its proper sense. And that's ironed out long before we get to the jury. But
no,
the concept that the jurors are supposed to accept the fact that a warrant was issued without knowing what a warrant is or where it comes from is we even have to tell them things about indictments, you know, like this is a mere formal way of getting you on the trial. You shouldn't hold it against you. But I fail to see what's wrong with the now, having said that, the prosecutor didn't ask for it. They said we had a warrant, we went to the judge, we got it, which is absolutely factually true.
I think the problem is that given the information the jury heard about why the police got the warrant, which is that they had been given this information by a confidential informant, the telling the jury that the judge then approved a warrant based on that information amounts to judicial vouching for the credibility of this confidential informant.
No, they're vouching for the fact that there's sufficient evidence for to go in and look. That vouching for the credibility, I think that there's enough there to do it.
But I think it's judicial vouching for the fact that a crime was probably committed or evidence of a crime is probably going to be found. And that is what is prejudicial.
Somebody says it's
going
to be found or sufficient to go look and see if it's true. That's all.
And okay. I think that it was improper under Cunningham for the jury to have that information.
Okay.
The last issue that I want to talk about this morning is the custodial interrogation under Rhode Island against Innes that occurred prior to any Miranda warning being given to
you,
Mr.
The
Hendricks.
One you described as a coy interrogation.
Coy interrogation.
I like that.
Thank you. And as I'm sure the court knows, what happened is that Mr. Hendricks asked during the booking process about what he was going to be charged with. Officer Moore didn't directly answer that. He said, "We found something." Mr. Hendricks replied to that by saying, "All you'll find is a pistol." And Mr. Moore says, "No, what we found is larger than a pistol." And that's the part that I think is particularly
coy. That doesn't sound particularly coy to me, but it sounds your guy was talking when he should have been listening, but that's not the fault of the police officer involved.
I think it is the fault when the police officer
he's asked, "What am I charged with?" and he tells him.
He didn't tell him what he was going to be charged with.
No, but he says, "We found something." He
said, "We found something."
Yeah.
And I think that was deliberately ambiguous, and that a reasonable officer should have known that was going to provoke
some new
response. You
give the officer credit for too much.
Yeah.
Well,
it does seem to me kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't, because the officer says we found something else. If the officer had said we found the following models and makes of guns, perhaps that would have been wrong too. And the odd thing is here. This officer thought it was such a trivial encounter, he doesn't even write it down until later somebody says, well, you know, maybe you better make a note of this. It's hard for me to see how the statements he made so clearly invited an answer from Mr. Hendricks that they fall over the line here.
Well, I think if the officer had answered the question directly, under this court's precedent, there wouldn't be a problem here. If he had said, we found a sawed-off shotgun, he's just answering the question he was asked. Or if he'd answered the question, what am I being charged with? You're being charged with possession of a firearm by a felon. There wouldn't be a problem here.
But
he
sometimes didn't. The police don't know what the prosecutor's going to charge. I mean, in fact, this case appears to have begun as a drug investigation until the informant snorted the heroin. And then it changed into a felon in possession of a firearm.
That's true. If he didn't, it's an unusual case.
Yes.
If the officer had simply answered, I don't know what you're going to be charged with, I don't make those decisions, there wouldn't be a problem here. But instead, the officer played this game with Mr. Hendricks, and it's that game that's problematic because it's the game that invited a response. And I think that a reasonable person in the officer's position should have known that when he said, well, it was larger than a pistol, it's like saying bigger than a bread box, and it's inviting Mr. Hendricks to guess at what was found or to make some sort of an incriminating statement about what was found. Thank you.
Good. Thanks. Mr. Connell.
Good morning. My name is Paul Connell. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney in the Western District of Wisconsin. I was responsible for the prosecution of the defendant in the district court. The defendants raised three issues here today, the first of which is an equal protection claim under Batson with regard to what took place at voir dire. The defendant waived as an elected matter of strategy not to raise and not to bring the arguments he raised post-trial and in his briefs in this court. He didn't raise those in the district court. He did that as a matter of strategy.
But, you know, I have trouble finding waiver or forfeiture here. He moved for mistrial, right? Isn't that kind of the biggest objection you can make?
He didn't move for a mistrial, Your Honor. I mean, in his motion for a new trial, he asked for a new trial based on...
Yeah.
Okay. That's correct.
So
but
he asked for a do-over, and it seems to me that's... And he also, of course... at the beginning of the trial, says something to the effect of, you know, I have my Batson objection, and the judge said something noncommittal, but it seemed to me what the judge was saying could reasonably understood by defense counsel is, yes, I recognize you've made that objection, it's here on the record, and now we're going to move on.
Why do you bother talking about a waiver? The judge found that you had a legitimate reason for doing what you did.
In Your Honor,
that's all you have to do is...
That's correct.
Write that out. Either she was right or she was wrong.
Excuse me. I didn't mean to talk over you, Your Honor. Our view here is there is not just forfeiture, but the affirmative steps taken after voir dire. They ordered the transcript. They had 6 days. They made this tepid comment before the start of trial.
That's like a coy question.
Yes, it's a coy question. But they did make a comment. I mean, yes, they ordered the transcript, but...
And they raised no issues post-trial or in their briefs that they couldn't have raised before the trial. We could have fleshed this out on the morning of trial. That's why we make our waiver argument. I appreciate the court doesn't like to find waiver.
Especially when this much is done by defense counsel. I mean, certainly if somebody stands up and says, we've decided not to make a Batson objection, of course, there's waiver. There's a conscious decision to forego something.
And I agree with you, Your Honor. This court, I appreciate, doesn't like to find waiver. Here, at a minimum, though, there is forfeiture. That's reviewed for plain error.
So what's wrong with what counsel said, though, at the beginning, where counsel reminds the judge that they're still trying to preserve a Batson argument?
If you look at what Judge Crabb said in her order denying the motion for a new trial, she said she didn't understand them wanting to be heard on the issue more, just that they felt they had... You know, they had made their...
The issue was preserved, is what she thought. She didn't want anything was necessary for further argument. But
that's what I think.
Why don't you just get on, stand on the fact that you thought you did the right thing and move on?
And Your Honor, then I'll turn to that. If not waived or forfeited here, it would be reviewed for clear error. There is no clear error here. My stated reasons at sidebar have nothing to do with race. I identified a specific reason for striking Mr. Woodland because his stepson was in prison for armed robbery. Ms. Harrison, who's an African-American as well, because her brother committed murder with a firearm, and Ms. Strock, who was a female Caucasian whose stepfather was in prison for a drug offense.
What about the fourth?
And Your Honor, that is sort of what I would call it's Ms. Martin, not Mr. Martin, is the other juror. And in my mind, during voir dire, she, when the question was asked, have you or any member of your family been convicted of a crime? She answered that as a juvenile, her brother was convicted of, I can't remember the crime exactly, maybe it was armed robbery, and had done some time in a juvenile facility. And to me, I kind of put that on
He was not in prison at that time. Her brother was...
That's correct. Ms. Martin was 49 years old at the time of jury selection.
This happened 20 years ago or something?
A while ago, that's correct, Your Honor.
Brother.
And then her other brother was a law enforcement officer, and she had a cousin who was a victim of a gun crime. And so to me, those kind of plus factors outweighed the...
Well, your position is if somebody had said, why is Ms. Martin still on the jury, you would have said that the juvenile detention wasn't on the same plane as being in prison for murder, and this was a line one could draw.
And this back and forth that we're having here is exactly the sort of thing that should have taken place at the sidebar. So my reasons were facially valid. The judge found that. The defendant has made several arguments. He relies on Miller L. I would just point out, you know, in Miller L., it is so different as to be unhelpful. Among the findings before the Supreme Court in Miller L. were that for decades leading up to the time this case was tried, prosecutors in the Dallas County office had followed a specific policy of systematically excluding blacks from juries, and there's just nothing like that here. The CSI argument, I merely indicated to Judge Crabb after defense counsel noted that two African Americans have been struck from the panel, that an additional reason that I struck Mr. Woodland was that he was a CSI viewer. When I can, I strike those people. They tend to look for more complicated evidence than they're going to get in a regular criminal trial.
Could I interject here? I confess I've never seen the show. I know that puts me in some other world, I guess.
But he's too busy. He doesn't have time.
I have little kids. My wife and daughter always watch different things. I don't want to say what, but it's things I'm not interested in, and I like the news, and I just haven't seen the show. But apparently this is routine on the CSI stuff, because you want to tell people, apparently, see if the jury expects that kind of searching evidence on every case. Is that why that's done?
Your Honor, I have two parts to my answer. There's a body of research that these shows tend to have some impact on juries. These type of shows have some impact on juries and what they expect.
More demanding for a prosecutor?
Looking for things that we just don't do in a normal run-of-the-mill felon in possession case.
DNA evidence. They want, you know, the laser, you know, studies.
That's exactly right, Judge Wood. And I even noted that. I do it in every opening argument. I point that out to the court.
This down on a piece of paper? Is there anything in the record that says, you know, that you had just kind of made a little note about this, or is it just your testimony?
There's the only thing that's in the record is my reference from the sidebar. Judge let me refer to my notes, and I looked at my notes. I mean, obviously.
But your notes are not any more of this world.
They're probably in a box in my office, but...
Okay.
Not in the record, though.
Not in the record. That's correct, Your Honor. And then the last point...
You kick out people to watch Judge Judy, too? I mean...
I can't say that.
I'd be tempted to do that, because she's mad all the time.
Unless there are other questions from the court about the Batson issue, let me turn to the second issue, which is this issue about the search warrant. And... the defendant has argued that his right to a fair trial was violated because there were references during the trial to a search warrant being approved by a judge.
The thing that's bothersome about this, of course, is the judge had very specifically said, don't refer to that. Rightly or wrongly, she said that. And then when the prosecution turns right around and allows that evidence to come in the record, through the witness, I understand, it wasn't out of your mouth, but...
Your Honor, in anticipation of that question, I can tell you two things. First of all, it was a complete brain lock on my part. I just was reading off my script. But if you look at what happened after Detective Cunningham testified, first of all, when I asked the question, they didn't object, they didn't move to strike, they didn't do anything, and they knew they were supposed to. And if you look at the record at 58 of page 19, the defense counsel was aware, even though they were making this motion, and that they still had the obligation to object if it was really important to them. But then secondly, if you look at the sidebar after Detective Cunningham Detective Hendrickson testified.
Hendrickson. Said, yeah.
After he testified, they moved for a mistrial, and there was some talk, and everyone was a little confused about exactly what was in play and out of play. They wanted not only there to be no reference to the judge approving the search warrant, but that the search warrant, they didn't want any reference that it was for firearms. And the judge was like, well, I didn't understand my ruling to be that. And
I'm
not standing here saying that I was remotely confused. I mean, I heard her tell me not to ask it, and I just was reading off my questions, and I asked it, and it got answered so quickly that it was just over just like that, just as things happen at trial. And again, there was no objection by the defense. They plainly waived it, and if it was really that important to them, they would have asked for a curative jury instruction, which they failed to do so.
Of course, I mean, oftentimes people, it's a strategic question at that point. You shine a big spotlight on it by saying, well, and you know, let's instruct not to.
And in her order denying the motion for a new trial, Judge Crabb noted that she ordered it, that it was violated, but it was harmless, and especially in light of all the other evidence in the case, in particular defendant's statements, which I'll turn to now, which is the last issue in the case. The defendant argues that the district court erred when it denied his motion to suppress these post-arrest statements. This court reviews the legal conclusion de novo that the defendant was not subject to custodial interrogation and reviews for clear error the factual findings and credibility questions. Here, Mr. Hendricks was never interrogated. He was never subject to the functional equivalent of interrogation. He made three really damning admissions. Upon his arrest and transport to the Dane County Jail as he was being booked in, he repeatedly demanded of Officer Lester Moore, who wasn't even an investigator in the case, he was merely a transport officer, what he was going to be charged with. And what came out at trial was that in between the time when they left Mr. Hendricks' residence and by the time they got to the jail, Officer Moore had been told that there was a firearm found at the scene of the search. And in light of Mr. Hendricks repeatedly demand, what am I going to be charged with, in addition to the operating after revocation charge, which was the thing he was taken down there for, Officer Moore just told him, well, there's going to be additional charges for you. And at that point, the defendant just blurts out, well, all they will find will be a pistol. And Officer Moore, who at this point is standing about 7 feet away and facing away from him, kind of turns to him and says, well, it was larger than a pistol. And then the defendant blurts out that he calls everything a pistol and words to the effect that he only got the weapon to protect himself because his apartment had been broken into on an earlier date. He made those statements back to back. They weren't result of any question. And Officer Moore, again, as you point out, Judge Wood, thought so little of it, he didn't immediately do anything about it. It wasn't until he mentioned it to the case agent that the case agent asked him to prepare a report. And even then, Officer Moore took several days to do it. Unless there are questions from me, I would just rest on the brief filed. My argument here today, ask you to affirm the judgment and conviction in all respects.
Okay, thanks. Your time run out. I'll give you 30 seconds if you've got anything to add. Otherwise, we can go on. We ask you a lot of questions, so I'll let you give the answers here.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just have one thing to add, and that's with regard to the violation of the motion in limine. The defense did not have to object after the violation of the motion in limine in order to preserve the claim of error. Rule 103 tells us that, and the Fusting decision from this court tells us that the motion in limine itself resulted in a definitive ruling, and that was sufficient to preserve the claim of error, so it's not waived.
Okay. Thanks. Case will be taken under advisement. I understand you were appointed, is that correct, Mr. Kelly? We thank you for your good work for your
Indeed.
Client.
Good job.